that more, I think, in the copy icons in particular, when you see more of the stories and that kind of thing. And they're, again, just incredibly beautiful. All right. Moving on this way. Moving to here, these are a couple of really much beloved saints from Russia, Seraphim of Sara and St. John of Kronstadt. Take the time to look at his photograph, even take it down and carry it up there if you'd like to, and compare it to the icon of him. It's the one on the far right up there. And it gives you a sense of two things: how similar an icon looks to the real person, how different the icon looks to the real person. Alright. The grouping that is here are primarily here for convenience, because they're ones that we take over here almost on a daily basis. So the crucifixion is over there right now because we're on Friday. And then the, let's see, the angels will be there on Saturday. And then this is the icon that most of you know from the Old Testament. This is Elijah being fed by the raven who was bringing bread to him. So that one doesn't move over there a lot, but it's Friday. And I think we talked about the banner. Someone asked a question about that. We have processions, and processions usually go out the door and around the church, and they're sort of a decoration of carrying maybe a feast that we're having or Pascha or something like that out into the world. Usually the bells are involved. And by the way, we have a new bell. You can't see it, and it's not actually a bell. But it is a type of a bell, and it's a flat sheet of titanium about this size, like that. When we walk up here, you'll be able to see the thing that it's hanging on. And it is, in sound, it replicates essentially the same sound of about a 5-ton bell that is about this size. And it does a pretty good job of complicating. A lot of engineering went into it, and it's a difference of about $70,000 between the real thing and that sheet of titanium that's up there. But that will be incorporated into our life in the church soon, so if there's no place else to put it right now but there, and it is pretty loud, so be prepared. And probably the first time you see it would be up here on some Sunday when one of the kids goes up there and hits it with something. And it will accentuate something in the service. God only knows what. We'll wait and see. Okay? Alright, come back up here with me, please. So are there any further questions about any icons or anything out in the church? Yes.
What are the reads behind some of the icons?
I'm sorry?
What are the reads behind some of the icons?
Behind some of the icons?
Yeah.
Pascha stuff.
Oh, those are palms. So on Palm Sunday, we hand out palms during the service, and so people have them during the service, and then at the end, it's a custom to make them into crosses. So that was made into a cross and stuck up there, and then we just kind of leave it, and at some point it falls down, and you burn it or something like that. But that's all it is. And there's some, like the Ethiopians, for instance, have this incredible ability to weave these things. They do these very elaborate weaves of crosses that, you know, you say, wow, how did you do that in 10 minutes? So that's just something that happens here. Okay. Anything else? Odds and ends. All right. Then I'm going to open the doors to the altar area. And I don't want you to pass beyond that door, please, but I want you to walk right up to it so you can see in. Feel free, if the space is all locked, to open this door and look through this way. You'll be able to see here. Same with the one over there. Okay? Let me give you that word in the way that I want you to understand it, if I can, because when we would say the symbol, something is a symbol, it represents something else, right? It represents another thing. So what would be a symbol? That's a peace sign. That's a symbol, right? Okay, symbol of peace. But the way that we use symbol, that I will use it very often when I'm saying things to you about things in the church or things theologically and what have you, is that I'm using the Greek word symbolon. It's the root of the word that we translate into symbol and symbolos. And what it means is to complete, make whole, and bring everything together. So can you guess what the opposite word of symbolos is? What would we divide, separate, and all that sort of thing? Diabolos. You've heard that word, haven't you? Devil. Diabolos. So diabolos is the opposite. So diabolos is to separate, confuse, divide, make in obscure. Symbolos means to bring it together and make it clear. This really confused me when I was becoming Orthodox, because I would look at the Nicene Creed and say the symbol of the faith. I think, well, how's that a symbol of the faith? You know, isn't it the theology of the faith and that kind of thing? And then later when I found out that it makes everything clear and brings it all together, there you have it. Makes perfect sense. So when I say that the altar area in an Orthodox church is the symbol of the heavenly church that you hear about in the book of Revelation, I don't mean that it's symbolically in that other sense, but rather that it represents it so that you see it. Okay? There's the mercy seat. And so I want to just explain what things are in here and what they mean. This is just to cover the altar, the holy table as it sometimes is called. As you'll see, it's cubic in shape. It represents the tomb of Christ. So you could say then, well, why isn't it shaped like a tomb? Well, if you ever happen to go to the Holy Land, you will see that the tombs tend to be shaped like this. They don't lay people out, and then at least historically, but they would make them small so that they would conserve space because they don't have a lot of burial area there. And if you're standing where the Golden Gate is in Jerusalem, it's all bricked up, and you're looking across the Kidron Valley. This is where you'll see the sepulchres, where all the tombs are, where everyone wants to be buried in Jerusalem, because they know that when the Messiah returns, he's going to go through that golden gate, and they want to be resurrected and ready to watch. They want a front row seat. And so those are, at this point, they're extremely expensive graves as well, so they really economize on them, but it's been the case for a while. So that's the shape. And there are just a few things on the altar. One is the gospel book. This is a book that has the four gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as you see them on the door, right? Okay. So it isn't a Bible in the sense of the way we think of it today, with Old Testament, New Testament, epistles, and things like that. This one is a liturgical Bible. It's one that's used in the worship service. So it has the four gospel four particular gospels in it, because that's what's read out of it. It's ornate. You know, it's beautiful. It's carried in procession, and so you'll see, you know, the deacons go out to carry it. They'll hold it above them and carry it out into the church, and they're very careful with it, and very often fans and crosses and everything go with it, and candles. And all of this is because this contains the words of life, the living words of Christ. So we treat it with great respect. Alright? And then, the only other thing that you would normally see on the altar is the blessing cross. And this is the cross that we bring out when we're passing out the blessed bread. Hold it up, people venerate the cross. So, as I've told you, with icons, they would kiss the foot of Christ. Sometimes they'll kiss the hand of the priest while they're making that veneration. And in this particular case, of course, what you're expressing is your appreciation for the Lord being crucified for you. Right? That's what it means to kiss the cross, is to thank you. Thank you for doing that. It's harsh and difficult. Right? Underneath the Bible, underneath the gospel book, is a cloth, and you won't be able to see it very well, but if you look right there, you'll see it very well. That's what it looks like, only it's a small version of it. And that's a, I guess the best word we would have in English, that's a burial cloth. It's, in Russian, it's called pashenitsa. And it's brought out on Holy Friday and used during that period of time. It's put in a bier. What else would we call that? Funeral bier, you know, the thing that you carry the body with. It's put in the center of the church, and people venerate that during Holy Week. And there's a whole service that goes with it and everything. And so that's the pashenitsa. The Greeks would call it an epitaphios. You'll hear these words. You won't remember that I said them tonight, but you'll hear them. And some of the things in church tend to be talked about in the original languages. So there's not a Russian in this church would ever call that a burial plot. They say, oh, today's the service for the Plashenitsa. And you go, what? it's an interesting thing. I'm getting a kick out of this. When a bishop is here, there is a number of times during the service we sing to the bishop, many years. May God give you many years. And in Greek, that's ispola edidespota. So you hear that song. And there was this Russian woman in the parish who always wanted more Russian in the service. And so the bishop came they were singing ispola. It's kind of a sing-along, beautiful version of it. And so they were singing that, and she turned to the lady next to her, and she goes, at last, more Russian. It's Greek. But she heard it growing up, right? So she assumed, she didn't understand the church Slavonic. So to her, Greek was Russian, whatever, it's what I'm used to. We got familiar with those things. It's probably a good time for me to talk about that just a little bit right now. We do use a little bit of Russian in our service. We do use even a little less Greek. But it's kind of in the case of the Greek, it's to honor the fact that it's the original language it came from. And there's a lot about theology that really requires an understanding of the Greek words to be able to grasp. And, of course, the Bible was written in Greek, most of it, some of it in Aramaic, but mostly in Greek. And so the Greek, we're very, very indebted to the ancient Greek language. And so it's brought into the service at times. So say something like that, Ispilaki Despota, would be in the service in the period, and you know, that comes from that. We have a lot of Eastern Europeans in our parish, and a number of them are old. And they don't even speak English, or barely speak English. And so we put a little bit of church Slavonic in the service for them so that they'll be able to hear their language. And you might say, well, that, you know, why do you do that? What's the big thing about it? Well, let's put it this way. If you've ever moved into another language and lived in it for a while, it's really difficult, especially at first. And you know, maybe you're learning French or whatever, and you're living in that language, and then you're walking down the street and a couple of people going by speaking English, you run to them, you know, just so you can talk. And it's like, you know, learning a language gives you a headache, and, you know, it's very difficult to try to live in. And then when you hear your language, you love it. Or if you go to a meeting or something and there's another English-speaking person there, you immediately find them and, you know, and talk to them the whole night so that you can have your language back. So to them, it's our way of saying, we're glad you're here, you're welcome here. It's not a lot. It's a little bit. But it's very meaningful to them to have that. So you hear that from time to time, and that's why we do that. Okay. All right. Back to the altar. So this is folded up, and usually it's not unfolded like this, but except for in service. Now, inside of it is a sponge, and that's just a practical thing. We use it because we have little crumbs and things like that that we deal with. And then, as you can see, it looks like that Plashenitsa over there, right? Parable. And this, you have to have this in order to perform divine worship. So if this isn't on the altar, we can't have a liturgy. And it says, by God's mercy, this one in particular says, written with the blessing of the whole Synod, the Alexandrian Orthodox Church in America, consecrated by Bishop Keefe from the city of Los Angeles in 1994, and so on, and it's signed by him at the bottom. And that has to be there. All of those things have to be there. And let's say that, for instance, the church for some reason gets in a fight with the bishop and there's a big row going on or something like that. So the dean, who's the person directly over the local rector, would simply come and take this away. And that would be it. No more services at the altar, nothing. So every Orthodox church has this. And it is, you know, very meaningful to us. It's very important. Also, if I lift it like this, let's see, if you see this, see that? Okay. That is the relic of a martyr. And you have to have that. In other words, these are not completed until the relic of a martyr is sewn into them. And it goes back to the time in the catacombs when I was talking with you somewhat about this earlier, that when a new Christian was martyred by the Romans, when they would go to the catacombs to worship, very often they would have a liturgy on the casket of the newly martyred person. And that became, you know, kind of the tradition of the church, such that the martyr's relics are on every altar in the Orthodox Church.
Does it have what's the process for it to get to that state? From beginning to end, for it to be in that spot? Is there anything else that goes with that besides the relic? The blessing process of veneration or something?
Well, when the bishop establishes a church, then he gives it to him. And he signs it, and like, this isn't our bishop anymore, the one that signed this, it's the one previous to this one. But he signs it, and that's essentially, you're good to go now.
It's like almost like a contract. I mean, it's kind of like...
It is a contract of a sort, yeah. Yeah, and he, normally they'll do it here. You know, they'll come, they'll do everything right there, and again, it's... I've only had to do it a time or two as a dean. I've had to, you know, go in where a priest was in disobedience and take away until things got straightened out. So it's rare that it would have to happen, but it's poignant when it does. So let me cover that up. Yeah. So this has a name. It's called an antimensium. And essentially, part of the decent translation is in the place of the table. So that's what an antimensium is. A lot of these words are just very practical. Then, on the back of the altar is the tabernacle. And so the tabernacle, the door that opens here, and this is oil that we use for blessing and things like that. But if I lifted this, this is portable, this part I lifted off, it looks like a little tomb. And inside of it, it's filled with pre-consecrated hosts. So on Holy Thursday, during Holy Week, rather than having one lamb that's consecrated, two are consecrated on that day. And at the end of that service, the second one is cut into little pieces, little squares about that size. And then the blood from the chalice is touched to every one of them. So all those are touched. It's, you know, it's in a tray about that size. And then you leave it out to dry. So it takes about 4 days until it's dry and really hard. And then you place it in here. And then this is available in case someone is sick or something like that, and we need to go quickly and take communion to them. This is what we use for that. So typically on a Sunday, maybe two or three of us, after everything else is finished, will be going to a nursing home here, a hospital there, that kind of thing, taking these reserved gifts to people so that they can have communion on that day. There's a little service that goes with it that prepares them, and so they receive these gifts. Now, if you're ever here, and the church is on fire, and you have to get one thing, this is what you get. This is the thing you get. Because this is the last thing we really want to have burned or be destroyed. Very careful about that. And believe it or not, that happened all the time. Because that building over there burned in 1995, and the fire was raging, and it looked like it was going to spread over to here. And I'll never forget when we were doing the work on putting these two buildings together, the fire department made us put three thicknesses of drywall between this building and that building up in the open area where the roof is. And I was cursing them at the time. This is so much work. This stuff's so heavy. I can't believe they're making us do this. Well, guess what it did? It saved the church. So, God bless them. God bless the codes, some of them. At any rate, my wife and I were at the coast with the teenagers from the church, and we were having a camping trip. And one of the deacons was told about the fire, because we were living up here, and so he rushed over, and he did what anyone would do. He came into the church, went past the police, went past the fire, and they're all yelling at him. He came into the church, and they're afraid it's going to light up. And he came up here, and they're chasing him. Came up here, grabbed it, went out that window, holding it, you know, and they arrested him. They arrested him out there and got a ladder and got him off the roof. And, you know, they put him in the back of the police car, and people were telling me about this. He's in the back of the police car, and he's holding the tabernacle. So from the church's point of view, he did exactly the right thing. And they did love God. You know, someone explained to me why it was so important. And don't you ever do that again. Okay. All right. So that's the tabernacle. And it has the reserve gifts in it. And these are called fans. And they have cherubim on them. And, you know, I used to look at these and I would think, you know, this is some kind of odd Byzantine flourish. You know, where did these things show up and why are they here? There's probably no good reason for them. It just started happening and now we have it. But that was until I went to Africa. I spent about 2 months there. And when you have communion in Africa, particularly out in the bush, guess what? There are a lot of bugs. A lot of bugs. And they love that sweet smell of the wine, and even the host. So you have two subdeacons who spend the whole service doing nothing but holding this over the chalice and shooing bugs away. the whole time. And that's what they're for. So obviously we don't need them for that. On rare occasion we'll get a yellow jacket or a fly or something like that, but we're usually able to manage that. And so that's what those are for. This is a processional cross. And you'll see it when we go out of procession, it has a particular place. Seven branch candlestick always stands behind the altar. It's not sitting on it because it ends here, but it's on a shelf. Below on the shelf, that you, what you can't see is all the icons, because people, when they have icons and they're going to use them in their home, they bring them in to have them blessed. So they cook down here for 40 days, approximately, and then at the end of that time, they're blessed with holy water and they go back. Behind this, these aren't supposed to be here. This is a temporary situation, and then, of course, this is St. Tikhon, who's moving out there, where I showed you soon. But this is the bishop's throne. Normally it's higher. When we remodel the church, this will be rounded right here. Pretty deep and pretty wide. And so the throne will be in the middle of that. It will be raised up a little bit. And we call it the bishop's throne. It's really the throne of Christ. But the bishop represents Christ. Not represents, but represents Christ. And so the throne is there so that, for instance, when the priest is about to begin the service, there will be two actions in particular that will take place. At some point before he begins, he'll turn and ask forgiveness of everyone in the church. So when you see a priest doing this or this, that's what we're doing. And unless you're furious with us, then you forgive us. And if you are furious with us, you go, no, God. And literally we have to leave the service and go talk to you and work it out. And then we turn in this direction and we bow to the throne, because a priest is always serving with the blessing of his bishop. And we can't serve without that blessing. So we have immediate oversight above us. And even though in title I'm called the rector of this church, because I'm the senior priest here, it's the bishop's church. I work for him. And the bishop has the fullness of the priesthood. A priest is kind of like a junior guy, you know, who does what the bishop asks him to do. For a period of time in the early church, there were only bishops and deacons. And priests ultimately were ordained because, say in a town like Jerusalem, you had, very beginning, one church, one bishop, one congregation, wasn't a problem. Then over time you have maybe 10 churches. And the bishop would have to go from church to church. Well, that became untenable and impossible. And since there's only supposed to be one bishop in one city, therefore then they started having priests about around 100, along in that range. And so you have priests who would serve for the bishops in that setting. So we always remind ourselves that we are people under authority. And I think that's very important for us to remember, and because we ask it of other people. You know, there are things that I'll get into this later. All right, so Bishop's Throne, above in that area is the icon of the mystical supper, the same one that's up here. And typically, for instance, when that rounded area is back there, this will be painted on the wall. It'll be large figures, big fresco, painted there. And it's the Lord with his disciples at the Last Supper. And of course it's there because the main service that we do is the mystical supper. So it's the image of that. And then above, up here, is called what we call the Platitera. And that's the icon of the Theotokos, of the Mother of God, with Christ in her womb. So you see it there, right? Sometimes you'll see a circle drawn there, and he's in that circle. But that represents Christ in the womb of the Theotokos. And the first Orthodox church that I visited was a Russian church in Vancouver, British Columbia. Actually, it was the second. The first I visited was St. Elijah's Antiochian Church. It's a Middle Eastern church in Oklahoma City, but I was a college kid, And I was with my friend Mickey Holmesy, and I was just trying to take it all in. I didn't register too much at that time, only that they seemed to be up and down a lot. But when I was at that Russian church, I looked, and up here high was this enormous icon of the Theotokos of the Mother of God. And I thought, you know, I guess they are Mary worshippers. Look at that, even above Christ. You know, she's placed above Christ. Well, that was my Protestant mentality. I didn't realize that that was Christ in the womb, nor did I realize that where I was standing, if I had looked up like this, above my head in the center of the church was a huge icon of Christ, the Pontifrater, the ruler of the king of the universe, but I didn't know it was there. So I thought that was the featured icon. And I was kind of put off by it. But my judgment was too quick. Because basically the reason that that icon is there is to remind us of what our vocation is and what the meaning of this service, this mystical supper is. Because we are all called to do what she did, you might say, to the fullness. And that is be bearers of Christ, right? Until Christ is formed in you and so on. Everything in the epistles and the gospel talk about that. And so this is the person, this is the greatest disciple who ever lived. And that is the Theotokos, who bore Christ, gave birth to Christ, took care of him as a baby and all those things around that. And we're called to do the same thing in whatever way we're able to. It will never be like she did. That won't happen again. But at least in our way, we're meant to do the same thing. And one of the main ways that that happens in our lives is through the mystical supper, through receiving the body and blood of Christ, where we receive Christ into our very life. So then it makes sense all of a sudden. And as always, it's about her, but it's primarily about him. All Mariology points to Christology. And often the reason that people have issues with the Theotokos, with Mary, is because they have low Christology. In other words, they don't really think of Jesus as being the only begotten Son of God. It's more along the lines of God the Father is sort of the big God, the main God, the real God. And he's sort of forbidding, foreboding, and usually ready to do bad things if you don't behave. And then you have Jesus, who is, and I probably don't remember hearing this one, the only begotten Son of God. Jesus was more like the God-man that you could trust and get close to because he was incarnate and therefore he understood. And he sort of protected you from the Father. This is my stuff. And then the Holy Spirit was more like divine lightning or energy, you know, that happened in some way. And I think a lot of us, you know, you might relate to a little bit of this. A lot of us grew up with something along those lines. And the idea of how the Theotokos would fit into all that, or even what it would mean, was just impossible to really think about. Until you realize that this is the only begotten Son of God, begotten of the Father before all ages, light of life, true God, begotten, not made, one essence with the Father, who enters a woman's womb. Well, now we're talking about something. Now we're talking about a different thing. And all of that has to be thought through. Why her? And why this moment in time? And all of those things. It's so rich and so beautiful in the way that the church describes it and helps us understand it. And as you'll recall, when she was going to visit her sister, or not her sister, but her aunt, the Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, remember she went into hill country and went to the house. And when the doors were opened, Elizabeth greeted her, and the scripture says they were both in the spirit. And it says Elizabeth in the spirit said, "Behold, a child in my womb leapt for joy when you arrived at my house." And then she goes on and says, "Who's this you're carrying?" And then the Theotokos says, "My soul doth magnify the Lord, and my spirit doth rejoice in God my Savior." And you know that, that beautiful hymn. And ultimately she says, "For all generations shall call me blessed." So when someone starts giving me a hard time about the Theotokos, I always say, well, you're a fundamentalist, right? Yes. You believe in the Bible, right? Okay. Then how are, tell me how you're calling her blessed. Or is she simply a figurine that you take out and crush once a year for, you know, 2 weeks and put her away? Are you calling her blessed? Is there something along those lines going on? And that actually starts a pretty good conversation. So we're not Mariolaters, worshipers of Mary. We venerate Mary. We love Mary. But we don't worship her in any way, shape, or form. But we also very much honor the fact that she's the person whom Christ chose to be his mother. And that was not just some random person. You know, if you think about in the fullness of time, it says, what brought about the fullness of time? Finally, a soul humble enough, pure enough, open enough to the will of God to receive him in that way. It would be something more along those lines. And that's what we need to contemplate about her. And that then is not simply to glorify her because she's too humble to want that. But rather, it tells us what we need to do. So every feast in the church that is about the Theotokos, that celebrates the life of Theotokos, is a feast that is teaching us what we need to be like, how we need to enter into a proper relationship with Christ. Every one of them is about that. You see it as you, after you've been here for 30 years and you know, your 30th Annunciation service, you'll really have it by now. Okay, so over on this side is the proskomia table, or the table of preparation, and that is where the gifts are prepared. Now, not this coming week, but in 2 weeks, I think it's the 4th, right? Sunday the 4th? 2 weeks?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's right. Yeah. It's not this Sunday, the next. What we'll do is take this table out here, and I'll ask you to come to church at about 9:15, and I'm going to do the service that we normally do there out here, and I'll stand down here, and all of you can stand up above, and I'll walk you through all of it, and I'll explain everything that we do. So there's a loaf of bread that we're using, and it's very symbolic in our sense of service. And so I'll explain all of that to you and let you watch that. Because as I'll always say to you, there's nothing secret here. There are no secrets here. There's confidentiality around certain things. But there aren't any secrets. So everything, you know, any book that I have on the shelves over there, you can buy. You can get that book. No hidden mojo, nothing like that. Everything's available. And everything about our theology is available. You know, there's nothing Gnostic about it. Not something you get to find out after 10 years or anything like that. You know, our only limitation is our inability to grasp the ineffable. That's a limitation. You can't do anything about it except have a pure heart. But otherwise, everything is available. And that's why I like to open up the altar and let you look at it. There's nothing taboo or anything like that. You know, if this young lady walks through here, which she won't do, but if it happened, you know, there wouldn't be any lightning striking or anything like that. And every once in a while, a kid will do that, particularly little boys. You know, you can hear the whole thing happen here. You hear the parent, the kid gets in, and they go shooting across to the altar. So that will happen from time to time. And again, don't worry about that. It's not a big deal. You know, but it's a sacred space, and we'll keep it that way. Yes? Your confession would be confidential, right? But a secret would be like, I know things that you don't, you know, about the real creed. But you're not going to explain it out until I really know you're right.
So these are things that other people that are confidential?
Everything that the priest does is confidential, pretty much. Counseling, you know, but it's a good confession. So that's what we're talking about. Any other questions about the altar or the corpus?
I have a question about the tabernacle. Mm-hmm. Is that related to unction of the sick, or is that is it only giving them confession or a chance for that? for when you give that to sick people. Is that related at all to
unction? It's the Eucharist.
Is the giving of the Eucharist related to the unction of the sick, or?
No, unction is a different thing.
Okay.
Yeah, and that oil is not unction oil, by the way.
Got it. Okay.
Behind here you can't see it, but this is an oil container that contains myrrh for the oil that is used for chrismations. Okay, that's a very special particular oil. I'll teach you more about it over time. And then the oil that is used for the unction service or the sacrament of that service is kept over here.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. And of course, the reason that you take communion to people who are sick is that it's for healing of soul and body, life everlasting. Forgiveness of sins, healing of soul and body, life everlasting. Okay, so it's for their health and restoration. All right. Any other questions about here? No? All right. We'll close it up. Speaking two things. One is I'll explain all that when we do classes on confession. But it's pretty simple what they're doing. They're waiting in line. They go up. The stand that's next to the priest has the gospel and the cross on it. So they'll go up and they'll venerate the gospel. They'll venerate the cross. Then they'll usually their hands like this, place their head on the gospel book. And then they make their confession. At that point, and they're confessing to Christ, so they would say, Lord, forgive me, and so on.
And
they
put something over their
head sometimes? That's the stole that a priest wears that's one that goes around his neck and goes down like this. It's called the epitrachelion. And so that is used, that represents the arms of Christ. So that's to remind the priest and the penitent that it's the arms, it's Christ who's doing the forgiving here, you know, not the priest. And we use that, you know, like when, as I was saying, when we lead people into the church for baptism or things like that, a couple that's coming to be married, they're led in to the church that way. And again, it is symbolic of Christ leading them, right? You'll sometimes see someone, getting a blessing and they'll kneel down and the priest will put his epitrachelion over them and bless them in that way. And again, it's a reminder of who's really doing the blessing. When you see confession, sometimes you'll see the priest sitting and talking with the person, you know, who's next to them. And that has to do with age. Age and tiredness, the ability to stand for a long time. And priests honestly do confessions in different ways. Some are much more conversational, some are less so. On Saturday night, they tend to be pretty straightforward. On Sunday morning, Father John or Father Nicholas, you know, they're venerable, beautiful old priests, and they're going to give people time, and they don't really care how fast the line goes. You know, you may not get your turn, but they're going to be thorough with each person who comes. And, you know, you think of confession as a context for healing and restoration. And that's what they're doing. You know, they're working on that with that person, with the soul of the person, to see what they need, to hear what they need to hear, to not be rushed, to take it all in. And so, so it's not unusual for them to sit. And for me, I have to, people can't keep their head on the gospel because my back won't allow me to bend over that long. So, okay, please stand now. Anything else? Things you see in church you wonder about. Oh, there you go.
The bowing liturgy.
The bowing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We talked about that in the context of the body, right? You know, the tactile sense is in relation to worship. We hear that I talked about the five senses as they're used in worship. It relates to that. An example I probably gave was that when you enter the church from outside, you say the prayer of the publican, right? The tax collector, Pharisee, this crowd, and all that relates to the parable. Publicans sit in the back and be distressed and, you know, ask God to forgive him, have mercy on him, and the Lord says he's the one who went away in the righteous, not the proud. So we take that as a clue that we should be humble in the church. And, well, any time, actually, but especially with the church. And the, one of the descriptions that you see in the scripture of the Hebrew people, especially in the early days in the desert, they were a blank, blank generation. You know what it was called? Stiff-necked generation. That, you know, a proud person tends to stand like this. Well, who do you think you are? What are you doing in my church? That kind of thing. You don't want that, do you? So, since the body and the soul are connected, and what the body does affects the soul, and what the soul does affects the body, they'll often live together after the resurrection. So the body and soul connection is, we're not Platonists. In other words, we don't believe that the soul is trapped in the body, that the body is essentially bad, and that we have to get rid of it so we can be set free and fly away as a soul somewhere. That isn't Christianity. It doesn't teach that. This body that we live in is going to be with us eternally. Not in this form, thank God. But it will be reconnected. That's what makes us whole. And the body is very important. And so we, in our worship, we know that if we bow, if we make a prostration, make the sign of the cross, you know, that sort of thing, raise our arms in prayer, those all have effects. And you can feel it when you do it. You know, if you're really a really proud person, would find it kind of hard to make a good deep bow because it runs counter to who they think they are. Whereas hopefully you're happy to do that. You want to bow before God. And say, for instance, when we turn to each other, you know, during a service when we're asking forgiveness, we'll often bow like this, touch our hearts, and ask forgiveness of the person next to us. And again, that's to be humble before the person and say, I submit to you, have I harmed you, have I hurt you, have I done anything to cause that? So that's kind of a panoply, you know, of some of the things that we want to know.
Thank you.
What else? We're demystifying, or maybe I should say we're remystifying in the proper way. It probably means anything you want it to. I mean, I was first told that when you make a vow, or sometimes it's called a metanoia, which is translated in English as repentance. But what it means is, it literally is a change of nous, meta change, nous, noia. And it means a change of heart and mind and soul. So we repent of something, it means we turn from that thing that is not good, turn toward what is good. Okay? So that vow is sometimes called that. That's called a major metanoia. And so I was told is you make sign of the cross, you bow down, and touch the ground to remind yourself that you come from the earth, and to the earth you shall return. Okay?
That's probably a little T instead of a big T. Because I've heard a few other things through the years as well. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. It makes perfect sense. And I think someone would be fine knowing that. And yes, you know, remind yourself that the, you know, remembrance of death. You aren't going to live forever. It's forever. And you need to be humble and repent before God and touch the ground and that kind of thing. But I don't think that's the only thing. There are a lot of things that are like that, that are pious customs. But I would never want to sort of enthrone them. You know, they're not on the level of the Nicene Creed or how, you know, the understanding of iconography in the life of the church and things like that. Another example you'll see, you probably observe this, and that is as the priest goes through the church during the Great Entry, you'll see people reach out and touch the hem of his garment. Okay? That isn't in any liturgy text, that isn't anywhere. And it tends to happen more in Russian or Arab churches, more common in those churches. And what's happening is people are enacting the prayer of the woman with the issue of blood. When Jesus walked past her and she reached out, for all the reasons she shouldn't have done that and couldn't do that and was going to be in trouble for doing it, touched him, and remember he stopped, and he said, "Who touched him?" And so the disciples said, "Well, there's a big crowd. Lots of people touched you. What are you talking about?" He says, "No." He says, "Power went out of him." So the healing power that healed her in that moment, he felt it go out of him by the faith of her touching his garment. So when someone's doing that, they're probably thinking of someone that they would like to see healed, someone with cancer or that kind of thing. So they're making that prayer as they do that. But it's a little T. Not required of everyone, but a pious custom. And I don't put that down because I think pious customs are really helpful, especially if you understand them. And there's care around it.
God came from who he came and who he got and son and with mother.
Okay. One of the things that I would also talk to you about is that when you're standing in church, that you don't sort of have the stationary thing, right? So you have a nice pew to sit in and you put your family in there and all that. You're standing in church and so there's a fair bit of movement that goes on. And you might see someone next to you making a prostration all of a sudden, crying. Or you might see someone bowing or things like that. And what I want to say to you is just don't worry about it. You know, people are in different states of heart when they're here and something might suddenly move in their souls that they want to respond to in that way. And so you're going to see things like that and no one is going, "Oh, can you believe that happened?" or anything like that. It's not unusual for people to cry, even sob in church at certain times when maybe something is happening in their life. And we don't give anyone a hard time for that. And it's all part of the healing process, and sometimes we need to do that. So there's levity. Now, other than the sort of the process of entering the church and going through all that, the moving around thing that hopefully is primarily done by children who are disobeying their parents and running around the church the way they shouldn't be. Because ideally, once you get in here and you get sort of where you're going to be, pretty much you stay there. So it isn't that, I love the Orthodox Church because you can walk around anytime you want to, and come and go and things like that. No. There's a bit too much of that. But I want you to understand it isn't the way it should be. It isn't the norm. So don't join the crowd in doing so. If you have to go to the bathroom, fine, go to the bathroom. That's not the issue. You need to get tired, you need to sit down. Like these two old ladies right here. You need to do that, go right ahead and do that. You know, because they're aged and infirm. So, you know, that's okay. It's, you know, again, don't judge anyone for it. You shouldn't be judged for it. There's freedom to do those things. There isn't one size fits all in that sense. But the basic thing is to stand and be attentive and stay pretty much in the same place. Other questions in the church? Yes?
And then we like to people, I don't want to say what they do, but why do you do
that? Say again?
We like to people. What?
Why?
You
missed that class, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. I'll briefly go back through it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So there are candles in the narthex, and people come in and they light them here, or sometimes they'll light them over there. And basically, I tell a story about the fact that you have, standing right over there where the old ladies are, you have a grandmother, a daughter, and her daughter, the grandchild. So they're standing there together. And in this day and time, we have this. Electric lights. But in the early church, of course, that wasn't the case. And what they would have there is an alcove, usually. And then there would be one of those play lamps inside of it. You've seen those probably, especially if you've been to Jerusalem or someplace like that. And so you put oil in it, and so a wick that comes out, and light the wick, and that would light the church. Candles as well, in some cases. And so grandma's there, and because she's standing there, that becomes her church. Right? Orthodox are the same as Baptist in the sense that in the Baptist church, you know, there are certain pews that belong to people, right? I mean, the name isn't on them. But, you know, that's like in the church I grew up in, you know, I would sit next to my grandfather most of the time, and there's not any question about where he would sit. You know, it's his spot. And we're that way. I mean, you go to a meeting in the morning, you come back from lunch, everyone sits in the same seats they were in that morning. We're just kind of built that way. I don't know what that is, but that's what we do. So this becomes her spot. And you'll notice also in Orthodox Church, when someone dies, that no one will stand in their spot for a little while. You know, just kind of leave it alone. But, you know, that's Grandma Carter's spot. Just, you know, no one has to say anything. But then a guest comes and they go, oh, there's an open spot. I'm standing in. Okay, that's over. Ready to be used again. So this is that grandma's turf. And so guess who starts taking care of the wick? It's hers to do. And don't you get in between her and the candle, or you'll be in trouble. So she gets older, she dies. Her daughter takes over and begins to do that. But the thought comes to her mind that she, when she's doing this, she's thinking about her mother, and she's praying for her well-being. So the lighting of that thing then becomes a symbol of prayer for her mother. Then over time, it becomes candles in the center of the church. So it would be typical, let's say that you have two daughters, and one of them's being a rascal and the other's sick. Praying for Kathy so she will quit being a 16-year-old and praying for Sophia to get over this really bad role that she has. And so say your prayers when you're wearing the light candles. The candle, the light of the candle represents their life. That's it. Any other questions? Yes?
Head covering. Some of the women wear, some of the children wear, some of them put on before
communion.
Yeah.
Head coverings are not required. Okay, so it isn't something you have to do. And I think it's better that it be that way. Certainly in the scripture, you know, there's discussion of head coverings. And where the Apostle Paul talks about it and says that a head covering should be worn is in a particular culture where people who are, you might say, decent people, married and that sort of thing, would always do that, whereas a loose woman, a prostitute or someone like that, wouldn't do it. And so that's why he would recommend it in that setting. So people who pretty much will wear head coverings are, mostly Russian people will do that. And the Russian women will do that. Because any church you go to in Russia, they're going to have head covering. It's just a given. You would feel odd there if you didn't have one. Because you'd probably be the only one who did. So culturally it comes out of that.
if you went to the Greek church, you wouldn't see that much of it. Same thing at an Antiochian church, you wouldn't see that much of it. At a Russian church, you'll see more of it. Or a really traditional Greek church, you know, that has the yayas from the old country, they'll do that. So you'll see that in people who come from Orthodox cultures where head coverings are more de rigueur in the context of the church. There are a lot of people who wear them here who don't come from that background. And it's something that they're not required to do, but they find that they want to over time. And I think that, you know, one of the things is it sort of contains you. I noticed with the, for instance, with Ethiopian women in particular, when they're dressed in their native garb, after they receive communion, they'll immediately cover their mouth and their face with a scarf. And then when they go back to where they're going to stand, sometimes they'll cover their whole head so that they disappear into this cloth. And it makes perfect sense because they've just received the body and blood of Christ and they don't want anyone to talk to them or bother them. They want to be contained in that containment that gives them. Now, you see, that makes perfect sense, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why, you know, I wouldn't say, so I want all of you to wear Ethiopian, whatever the dresses are called, and when you receive communion, put it over your head. That'd get a little weird for us. But you may find at some point you want to do that, but you won't be forced to. Some people, say for instance, if you go to a Russian monastery, a Greek monastery, definitely take a head covering. Because they'll expect that monasteries, they're more, you know, they walk a tighter rope, and they'll expect that. So it was St. Monica, who was the mother of... St. Augustine. And St. Augustine was a real rascal of God when he was younger. You know, he was not born a saint by any means. You know, he was the opposite of that. And his mother was always praying for him and crying and weeping. So when we see a mother who has children who are being difficult, we often call them a Monica. You know, because they're going through that same thing and they're praying for them. And she loved St. Ambrose, who was the bishop in the city, ultimately Ambrose of Milan, in Italy now. And she knew him well. And he ultimately would baptize Augustine there in Milan. You can even go in that church, beautiful icons in that church, and there's a font, and there's a thing above it, you know, the plaque that said, in this font, St. Augustine was baptized by St. Ambrose. That's cool. So, you know, she was crying and, you know, asking St. Ambrose, what can I do? And St. Ambrose said to her, he said, my dear, as deeply as your prayer, you know, as deeply as you're feeling your prayer before God, I can't imagine that he won't answer your prayer, which he ultimately did, right? But she wanted to go to Rome on pilgrimage to pray. And they lived in Milan, Rome was pretty far away, and so she said to St. Ambrose, what do I need to know? What do I need to do when I go to Rome? And he says, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You've heard that before, haven't you? That's where it came from. And what he was saying is, there are customs in Rome that are different than Milan. Now, they're not more right or more wrong or anything like that, but when you go there, you want to be respectful of the customs of that particular place. So you would have, let's say, an example of this would be that Russians are really accustomed to standing in church. And so they'll go to an Antiochian church, an Arab church, and it has stadium seating. Not always, but it will have that sometimes. And sometimes they'll stand the whole service. You know, and everyone behind them can't see, and, you know, that kind of thing is there. Darn well not going to sit down, because that's not what you do when you worship. Well, it'd probably be better to do as the Antiochians. You know, if it isn't compromising anything, you know, just chill and sit down. You know, you don't have to do it all the time. But in this setting, it might be the best thing to do. So if it isn't a moral issue or something like that, and to me, it's part of the beauty of the Orthodox Church. is that I was raised in the beginning primarily in the Russian context. So I loved all things Russian. You know, everything is Russian, it's better. But then over time, I traveled all over the world. You know, the Middle East and Russia, Ukraine, all over the place, in Africa, and served in churches in all of these places. And they all have differences. Now, not huge differences, but differences relative to culture and things like that. The music is different. Head coverings are not head coverings, you know, things like that. It varies from place to place. And what you ultimately do is that you kind of loosen up a little bit and go, okay, that's how I was brought up in the Orthodox faith as an adult, but nonetheless, that's how I was trained. But it isn't like that everywhere, and it's not going to be like that everywhere. And what's really important is what? Why? What's in your heart? You know, when you're in church, it's your heart that's worshiping. And so that, you know, you don't want to get too caught up in the outer stuff. Now, we would say, for instance, when you come to church, you would dress reasonably. In other words, you wouldn't wear like a t-shirt with Ninja Turtles on it, or, I don't mean you, but, you know, generally. You wouldn't wear things that are distracting, right? So you dress nicely, but simply, and, you know, no big show or anything like that, you wouldn't wear shorts, for instance. That would be considered disrespectful in an Orthodox church, especially for now. And sometimes kids, you know, they wear these things that are here now. Little boys, but you wouldn't normally come in shorts to church because it would be disrespectful. So you cover yourself. You go to a monastery, you don't cover yourself, they will cover you. They have, you know, if you go in pants, they'll put a skirt on you. Nuns or monks. And if you have a short sleeve, they'll put long sleeves on you. They won't send you out, but they will have you follow their protocol. So when you're in monastery Rome, you definitely do what those Romans are doing. And it's just out of respect to them. So that's a broad answer. But, you know, I think it's the head covering thing alludes to a lot of other things. And I, personally speaking, I never want to put don't want to mistake the forest with the trees for the forest. So I think it's always important to have the big picture. And a fairly universal picture, ideally. And to remember what we're here for, what we're really here for. So that's kind of a broad stroke at it. Other questions? How are we doing for time? 8:10, 5 more minutes. Well, next week, we are going to we're going to get liturgy books from the back of the church. So when you come next week, get your liturgy book, and we're going to start talking about the divine liturgy and what the movement of it is, what's being done and when, why we do it when we do, what it's about. Because what I want to do is make it so that you can inhabit it, so that you can get inside of it and worship from it. Because it's really difficult to do when you haven't been raised in a liturgical setting. If you were maybe a high Anglican or a Roman Catholic or something like that, you would have somewhat of a sense of it because your worship would have been more like that. But if you come from a Protestant background or, you know, something like that, then it's very different for you. And I want to make an effort to make it accessible to you so that you can get a hold of it. Okay? There's a beautiful series of talks on Ancient Faith Radio. I was just thinking today, I'm going to get a handout for you. And I'm going to... how many of you have heard of Ancient Faith Radio? A lot of you have. Okay. It's an incredible, wonderful resource. It has podcasts and live things and all sorts of things. The guy who does it used to be the managing director of the Moody Radio in Chicago, you know, the Moody Bible Institute, until he got fired for becoming Orthodox. But ironically, my son-in-law's dad and he worked together at Moody Radio. So I actually have a connection with the government. But it's this wonderful thing that's available, and there are talks that are on there, and there are some that I would, you know, it used to be you just recommended books to people, or maybe tapes or something like that. Well, now we have this incredible resource you can listen to on the way, on your drive to work, or, you know, when you're working out at the gym, or when you're taking a walk or a run, or, you know, in the evening when you want to do a study, things like that. So I'm going to put down some of the podcasters and different areas that they address that I think would really be good for someone to be listening to during the period of catechesis. Okay? You know, there's one in particular that I would encourage you to go ahead and listen to now. And so you go to Ancient Faith Radio, podcasts, by author. Okay, it's all making sense so far, by author. And then you go to Father Thomas Hopko, H-O-P-C-O, Hopko. And then go to, I think it's Worship in Spirit and Truth. Is that right? Yeah, Worship in Spirit and Truth, where he talks about the Divine Liturgy. And he gets maybe halfway into it before he dies. He died a couple of years ago, so he didn't finish it. But he uses, he starts talking about it in somewhat broad terms, and then he uses the story of Fotini at the well, the woman at the well story, where that she has this discussion with the Lord, and he kind of brings her up a notch and brings her up a notch. And that's, you know, and then he will say that this worship is that worship. God wishes us to worship in spirit and in truth. And this is that worship. And then he makes the case. And it's beautiful, beautiful, incredible, incredibly good speaker. You know, just a really brilliant man, but not just a brilliant man, a spiritual, truly deep, deeply spiritual man. I'll talk about him more as we go on, because he was really important to me. You see a photograph of him in my office. But just a really gifted man who had a lot to give and gave a lot. Okay, so if you have time, you know, listen to those. Start listening to those, because they'll augment what we're talking about here, which is my way of saying you can listen to it.